really sorry, but it has been impossible to get another lecture theatre at this particular point. So I apologise. We'll simply proceed as we are here. Let me offer some comfort in the sense that the lecture will be available as a podcast to download from the internet from the pages of the Hellenic Observatory here in the European Institute. And you'll be able to then appreciate the lecture at leisure later on. But I'm afraid we have no other alternative other than to proceed as we are. It seems that our speaker needs no introduction because there's so many of you here, but nevertheless, I'm delighted to introduce Yanis Varoufakis, the Professor of Economics at the University of Athens, to speak to us of debt and denial, the crisis in the context of the post-2008 world. I'm sure you're aware of his work, his writings, his public profile on the debt crisis. I can only emphasize the spread of his academic career. He obtained his PhD from the University of Essex. We just discovered that we were both students at the University of Essex, but one of us was a student there more recently than the other. Let's pass over that. But in addition to that, having got his academic qualifications, he's held academic posts in a number of countries. Indeed, his academic career seems to have been designed to test the geography of the international university system. He has held university posts in Sydney, in Louvain, in Glasgow, in East Anglia, all over the place. He has held university positions. He is, of course, now for some time a colleague in the Department of Economics at the University of Athens of colleagues such as Lucas Papadimos. Whatever happened to him. So we will, the normal format is that we invite our speakers to speak for 30, 40 minutes, and then that should leave plenty of time for questions and discussion afterwards. We must leave by 7:45 this evening, but that gives us plenty of time. So without further ado, Yanni, welcome, and we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for squeezing yourselves in here like sardines. And what can I say to those of you who are outside? Thanks for coming, and apologies for the teleporia, as we say in Greek, right? There's no better word in English compared to that. I'll go straight into the essence of what I want to relate to you today. I want to talk about the crisis. I'm going to be saying very little about the Greek crisis. And you will see in a minute why I'm choosing to offer a very minimalist account of what happened to our beloved country. Firstly, I'm going to start by relating to you what I think is the worst legacy of this crisis. The crisis of Europe, the crisis of Greece, the crisis of Ireland, indeed the crisis of the United States, I dare say the crisis of the United Kingdom, the crisis that befell us starting in 2007-2008. Now, of course, there are many legacies that such a wide-ranging crisis, our own generation's 1929, I think, has. But the one I'm selecting with which to begin this talk is a strange and weird take on the legacy of this crisis. And it is this. This crisis is threatening to reinforce everyone's prejudices. When it erupted in the Anglo-Saxon world, beginning with Wall Street, the City of London, the collapse of the financial system of the world, we Europeans on the continent, continental Europeans, looked smugly on the other side of the pond and sort of felt that the Anglo-Saxons got their comeuppance after having been lectured for decades on the merits of the Anglo-Saxon model. Continentals were quite pleased somehow and worried at the same time to see what was happening to Wall Street and the city of London. When a few months or years later, Greece went the way it went, followed very fast and furiously by the dominoes of Ireland, of Portugal, now of Italy and Spain, and soon by the whole of the Eurozone, it was the Anglo-Saxons, or at least the British, who were justified to feel vindicated for not having traded the Queen on their notes for the abstract bridges and gates on our euro notes. Left-wing economists saw the 2008 crisis as yet another very decisive confirmation of the Marxist or quasi-Marxist prediction that capitalism cannot be civilized and even it can't be made to work. Using precisely the same data, exactly the same data, free marketeer economists concluded that it was another spectacular failure of government interfering in the smooth operations of otherwise well-functioning, brilliant markets. Surplus countries pointed the finger at deficit countries, and deficit countries were convinced that it was all the fault of the surplus countries. This is the worst legacy of the crisis, that if we are determined to see in it confirmation of our prejudices, we will find it. And then all we will have managed to accomplish is that we will have achieved a recapitulation, a reproduction of the very same mindset that brought that crisis about. What was this crisis? What is a crisis? Well, most people refer to this as a debt crisis. I'm going to make this controversial statement that describing what we have at the moment, whether this is in Greece, or in Europe, or in Japan, which after all has a 200% debt to GDP ratio, or the United States, or the United Kingdom, if we are to describe what we have as a debt crisis, this would be the equivalent to a medical doctor examining a cancer patient who is suffering a great deal of pain and pronouncing that this patient is under the spell of a pain crisis. Trivially true and utterly useless. How can I possibly say that this is not a debt crisis? I'm not saying that there is not a debt problem in exactly the same way that a patient suffering an awful cancer is certainly feeling pain. But the question is, are we getting to the bottom of things by describing it as a pain crisis or a debt crisis? The point is made much clearer if we go back a little bit in time, because this is not the first grand crisis. It is the second. We've had many crises in between 1929 and now, but our crisis now only compares to that of 1929. And 1929 should have taught us two things. The first thing is that when Wall Street collapses, well and truly collapses, perishes, and needs to be refloated by government, when every single merchant bank goes belly up and every single commercial bank is insolvent, and that crisis then becomes a crisis of sovereign debt simply because the states indebted themselves in order to refloat the banks. And the result of that is cutbacks as well as a general deterioration in the business climate, which reduces investment, causes private sector deleveraging, paying back of debt en masse, which then has an impact which we all experience, both in this country and in Europe, some of us in Greece a lot more harshly. That is deflation, a recessionary process. When that process begins, so financial sector collapse, come debt crisis, come real economic crisis, the first victim of it is the collapse of common currencies. In 1929, it was the gold standard, which was a common currency of the era. Today, it's the Eurozone. The slide into deflation, which is an inexorable process that happens if government submits to what I call the austerian logic, the logic that at the time of private sector recession, the public sector must live within its means, and simply because of the collapse of private demand and sales of goods and services, tax take is reduced. Tax take is reduced at the time when the financial sector is panicking and it is increasing, boosting interest rates in order to lend to government. Government then comes along and reduces public expenditure. When that happens at the macroeconomic level, what is the sum of private and public expenditure? It's GDP. So when both are reducing themselves, either automatically or by means of political decision making, then GDP falls. And that begins the vicious circle. When that happens in a fixed exchange rate arena, the common currency that I'm referring to here, whether that was a gold standard in the 1930s, early 1929 onwards, or the Eurozone today, the tectonic plates shift in a manner which ensures that the whole edifice is simply torn asunder. This is the first lesson we should have learned. We don't seem to have learned it. Well, the second lesson we should have learned from 1929 is that when all these things happen, then a Hobbesian war of all against all erupts. And it usually begins with sentences that start with, the Greeks are like this, or the Germans think that. Generalizations, in other words. Generalizations that are part and parcel of a mindset which seeks the causes of the crisis in moralism, which then transforms itself into jingoism. Polarization is an inevitable result. Nationalisms build up, racism and xenophobia triumph. So the two lessons of 1929 become one in the end. We end up with the retreat of logic and the triumph of misanthropy. We should have known that. A note on Greece. Only a note on Greece. I warned you from the beginning, I won't speak much about Greece. Greece is inconsequential. When I hear that Mrs. Merkel's first visit to President Obama lasted 2 hours in the Oval Room, of which 1 hour and 45 minutes had to do with Greece, then you know there is something profoundly wrong with the world, because Greece is not that consequential. Of course, Greece has managed in the past to be the snowflake of an awful avalanche, because let us not forget that we have managed that before with Greeks, to spark off a worldwide crisis, not an economic crisis at that time, but let us not forget that it was in the streets of Athens in December 1944 that the Cold War began. It was not in the streets of Berlin. To start one global crisis is bad enough. To start twice in half a century or so is decidedly a sign of carelessness. But let me make the point that even though every avalanche requires a snowflake, to blame the avalanche of the snowflake is to be unscientific. Greece is not inconsequential to us Greeks. People talk about the domino effect. What we have in Europe at the moment is not a domino effect. Because a domino effect, picture it in your mind, requires one domino to fall on another, Greece to fall on Ireland, before the second domino falls on the third one. If the first one doesn't fall, there is no domino effect. Well, that is not a good allegory for what the Eurozone is experiencing. The popcorn effect is a much better allegory. You know how we make popcorn? We take kernels of corn, we heat them up, and then suddenly they start popping. Not all at once. There's one that pops first and another one, a third. If you remove the first one that would have popped, will that stop the popcorn effect? No. Greece is inconsequential. had Greece never existed on the map of Europe, had it been nuked in 2004 or 1999, just before entering the Eurozone, had it never entered the Eurozone, Greece would have been better off had we not entered the Eurozone. But nevertheless, the Eurozone would be in precisely the same mire in which it finds itself. Now, there are two great errors that we Greeks make. The first one is to try to argue that we're not at fault for what happened. And you, some of you, I think Kevin is scribbling away there, that I'm probably saying something of the sort. Some of us Greeks would like to claim that it is not our fault, with a hidden agenda of not changing much, of doing nothing within Greece in order to address the very serious malignancies that our social economy is replete of. The other side of the same story is to think that this is a self-inflicted crisis. It is a crisis that we Greeks brought upon ourselves through corruption, tax evasion, profligacy, blah, 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 all the malignancies that I mentioned. And the hidden agenda there, not the hidden agenda, the hidden axiom there, is that if it is true that it is a self-inflicted crisis, then being model prisoners is the way to go. Model prisoners of the austerian logic that the European Union, the European Central Bank, and the IMF have imposed upon us. By the way, model prisoners is not my expression, it's one that is quite common in Ireland, I'm being told. I think these are two great errors within which the truth of the matter is annihilated and wasted. At the same time, there are two debilitating fears that we Greeks face. One is fear of change. I look at my university, I look at my department, I look at my students, I look at my colleagues, I even look at myself, and we all fear change. We may not like what we have, but we fear change. Another fear is that if we Greeks admit to the systemic nature of this crisis, it will be a little bit like letting ourselves off the hook. These are two fears which debilitate us. From what? From doing our duty as European and global citizens. And what is our duty as citizens, independently of nationality, gender, creed? To understand what on earth is going on. Because that which is going on is seriously circumscribing the opportunities of the next generation or two or three. And these fears and these errors are equally responsible for pulling the wool over our eyes. That is stuck. Okay. Allow me a Nietzschean interpretation of the Eurocrisis. It's not really a Nietzschean interpretation. I'm simply alluding to Nietzsche's rejection of good and evil, to his famous expression in the Genealogy of Morals, that good and evil are the two sides of the same coin, and those two sides are accomplices of one another in creating a coin which is effectively fake. My proposition to you will be that if we need to understand what went wrong with the Eurozone and how the Greek crisis fits into this and how the Eurozone crisis fits within the global crisis, we need to look at two distinct and yet interrelated phases of the problematic Eurocoin. Now, when we created the Eurozone in the 1990s, there were certain assumptions which, I might say, I might add at this point, many British-based and American-based Anglo-Saxon economists and politicians pointed out right at the beginning as problematic. The first one was the assumption that it is possible to have a common inflation rate forever and everywhere within the Eurozone, of around 2%, with minimal deviation around that figure. The second one was that we would have minimal interest rate spreads, interest rates raised, fetched by government when borrowing. Thirdly, that labor unit costs, the cost of producing a certain amount of output, would converge throughout the Eurozone during the Eurozone's coming to age. These assumptions were not only made, but it was important to make them in order to sustain a program of European Monetary Union without what I call a mechanism for recycling surpluses wherever they are being produced. But I'll come back to this in a minute. So what went wrong? Allow me to refer to the first one by means of a movie title that some of you may have seen. It's got nothing to do with the actual movie, but I like the title, Das Experiment. Because it was a unique experiment carried out in Germany. The only such experiment ever carried out was carried out in the 1980s in Australia. And I happen to know that because I was there and studied the phenomenon. What did that experiment do? It was after the unification of Germany. But Germany's debt skyrocketed, of course, and its economy fell into a hole. Effectively, it achieved very, very low growth rates, and the solvency of the German state, for the first time since the Second World War, was being called to question. And what was the experiment? The experiment, unlike what Mrs. Thatcher did here in the United Kingdom, was to try to eliminate unemployment through a wage deflationary process. A process of reducing wages. You see, Mrs. Thatcher did exactly the opposite. Boosted unemployment while at the same time allowing average earnings to go through the roof. In Germany, they tried to do the opposite. Eliminate unemployment while pushing wage inflation down. This they did in a typical Germanic, efficient, corporatist way, with after having achieved a very impressive degree of consensus between employers and trade unions that were still powerful at the time. And the result was that we had a violation of all three assumptions on behalf of Germany. If you look, I don't have a figure here, because I don't like PowerPoint presentations. I use this because it's got nice pictures. If you look at the graph of inflation rates in different Eurozone countries, you will see that there is only one country that stood by its word. 2% inflation rate. No, it wasn't Greece. Don't get happy. Yeah. It was France. Precisely 2%. You know, the Napoleonic French state set a course towards 2% inflation rate. It fulfilled it. Which was the worst deviant? Germany. Germany, who was bopping around 0%. Now you may say, well, that's a good thing to have very low inflation. No, it's not. One of the assumptions of monetary union is that we're going to have the same inflation, but we're going to have a target and we're going to stick to it. Because if you have deviations below, then you will have deviations above. And these deviations are tearing apart one of the assumptions of monetary union. Now, Greece was the other extreme. But I have to tell you that the Greek deviation from 2% was less than the German deviation. Now, this is not to apportion blame, because the blame game has to end. What we should seek, from now on at least, is comprehension. We are all in it together. It doesn't matter whose fault it is. First, we understand what happened, and then we try to find remedies for it. And then, when we're old, and just before we die, then we can indulge in a little bit of ethics. So this was the essence of the experiment. Now, that experiment meant, let me give you some numbers. Goods that were worth 100 euros in 1999, a basket of commodities that was worth 100 euros in 1999, both in terms of what they cost to purchase, but also in terms of what they cost to produce. Okay? In 2008, they were worth 107 euros in Germany. In France, the very same goods were worth 121 euros, and in Southern Europe, they were worth 133. So when we talk about competitiveness, and I hear Mrs. Merkel often say that the South has to catch up in terms of competitiveness. Now, competitiveness is a relative virtue. You know the standard joke amongst economists. One economist says to another, "How's your wife?" And the second economist turns around and says, "Relative to what?" It's not an absolute virtue, competitiveness. You are competitive relatively to somebody else. So Germany's grand success was bought at the expense of competitiveness of the South. By the way, do you know what this 121 means here? France will not be part of a new euro, of a new currency union amongst the strong. France is toast. France is not a AAA country. France will be left behind by Germany if the eurozone collapses. Now, the significance of this transcends the borders of markets for goods and services. It infects, importantly, and this is why those assumptions were crucial, it infects the financial sector. Because let's not forget that when we put together all our currencies in one basket and we created the euro, there was one currency that was more equal than others. It was a Deutschmark. Let's stop beating about the bush. The euro is the Deutschmark. It is not an accident that the ECB is 100 meters away from the Bundesbank in Frankfurt. And indeed, that was not a bad thing. We all wanted the Deutschmark. The reason why France was so keen on monetary union in Italy was because we wanted the Deutschmark. And we got the Deutschmark. So the Deutschmark was the anchor currency within the European monetary union, which meant that interest rates and generally monetary policy reflected the circumstances of the German economy. So interest rates were set in such a way as to reflect not the 133 euros in the south of Europe, not the 121 in France, but the 100 in Germany. So effectively, our monetary policy was predicated upon the presumption that the rest of Europe was the equivalent of a greater Germany, where the monetary policy of that greater Germany was going to be determined by the demand and supply of money in Germany, which means that the diminution of labor unit costs created incentives for German banks and French banks, and then through the circuits of finance, all the other banks of the Eurozone, to lend to the whole of the Eurozone at interest rates that reflected the circumstances of the German economy. Okay? So, oceans of cheap money flooded, starting from Germany and from the surplus countries, and Holland as well, the rest of the Eurozone. But there is another side of the story which is very important. And if we're looking for answers to what went wrong, we need to go beyond the borders of Europe. Something tremendous happened in the 1970s that started on the 15th of August 1971 when President Richard Nixon announced the end of Bretton Woods and the beginning of a new era. I'm not going to tire you with this narrative except epigrammatically to state what was the main change. Unless we understand that main change, we don't understand the Eurozone. From the Bretton Woods Agreement, 1944, or 1947, 48, when it started being implemented, to 1971, the world had a common currency, more or less, the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates, which is not different from the gold standard that existed before 1929 and which 1929 destroyed, with one big difference, something that the gold standard didn't have: a surplus recycling mechanism, a mechanism for taking surpluses from the surplus producers and giving it to the deficit producers in order to ensure that 1929 would not happen again. And who was that surplus recycling mechanism? It was the United States of America. It began with the Marshall Plan, with FDI in Japan, in Germany, and continued in various ways. America was maintaining a net surplus, trade surplus with Europe and Japan. And 70% of its surpluses were being recycled back to Germany, back to Japan, back to France. Throughout that period, it was what kept that system going and what turned the 1950s and the 1960s into the golden age of capitalism. That system broke down for a simple reason. America lost its surplus. By the end of the 1960s, it had become a deficit country. And what did it do? Something quite remarkable. It reversed that flow. It retained its capacity, its central position as the recycler of world surpluses, only this time it was not its own surpluses. It was the surpluses of other people, which it was, the United States was recycling. How was it doing that? Through its trade deficit. It was working, operating as a Hoover, sucking in the exports, the net exports of Germany, of Japan, later of China. Okay? And how was it financing this ever-expanding deficit? It was financing it by creating circumstances in New York such that other people's profits, the Germans, the Japanese, the Chinese, wanted voluntarily to rush into New York to finance the trade deficit of the United States of America. This is the environment in which the Eurozone grew up. I call it the global minotaur, because in exactly the same way as in the ancient Cretan myth, tributes from the weak, the weaker parts of the empire, from Athens in this particular case, kept the peace, kept the minotaur satiated, and peace and prosperity and trade going. In our case, it was a tsunami of capital coming from the surplus producers, that were not the United States anymore, into Wall Street, financing the deficits that were keeping German, Japanese, and later Chinese factories going. That was what closed the loop. Ben Bernanke mistook this for a great moderation. Gordon Brown mistook it for an era that ends bust and boom. They were all wrong. It was a magnificently anarchic surplus recycling mechanism, which broke down in 2008. Why? Because on the back of the capital that was flowing into New York, Wall Street built paper pyramids. And then it was followed by the City of London very shortly or at the same time, and then by Deutsche Bank, Societe Generale, BNP, who were worse than the Americans, the British, because they didn't even understand what they were doing. When those paper pyramids burnt down, that global surplus recycling mechanism died. And this is why the whole world is in this state of crisis, not understanding what hit it. Because we have not replaced that global surplus recycling mechanism, by the way. This is the story I'm telling, that the global minotaur died, and we are all suffering the ill effects of that. The point I'm making about the Eurozone could only maintain these assumptions, even if Germany had not produced its great experiment, while the minotaur was recycling the world surpluses through the trade deficit of the United States. To put it simply, ladies and gentlemen, the Eurozone was not designed to survive 2008. If we did nothing after 2008, it would collapse. If Greece did not exist and it had been nuked, it would have collapsed. Maybe not beginning with Ireland, maybe not beginning with Italy, it would have begun somewhere. And the whole edifice. It's like an earthquake hitting a block of flats that was never designed for an earthquake. But let me plug my book, which says this. I've been told I have to do it. So what are the two sides of the problematic Eurocoin? My Nietzschean interpretation. We have Greece and we have Germany. Of course, I could give you a lecture on Holland and Portugal, on Austria and Spain, but it would go on and on and on. The point I'm making here is that we created a Eurozone which would have created a Greece and a Germany even if we were all Greeks or even if we were all Germans. Let me make a very simple point to you. Take this country. This country is not homogeneous. You have the economy of Greater London, which is quite distinct from the economy of Yorkshire. You have the economy of Wales, which is quite different from the economy of Sussex and Surrey. Whatever you do in this country, there's always going to be a deficit by the Welsh vis-a-vis the English. Always was, always will be. God himself could not change that. Now, you don't have a debate.
Despite being English.
if she's English, I'm quite happy. Now, what keeps the sterling area intact? Even during periods of recession, what kept the United States intact in the 1930s? People suffered. The grapes of wrath got heavier and heavier. But no one ever questioned the sustainability of the US dollar zone. Well, what kept it together was the surplus recycling mechanism within that union. So, in the United States of America, you have the military-industrial complex. So when Boeing goes to the Pentagon and says, I'd like $1 trillion over the next 15 years to develop the new fighter jet, the Pentagon says, okay, but I want one factory in Tennessee, one in Arizona, one in South Dakota, and one in Illinois. Why? Because these are the deficit areas. This is not a case of philanthropy towards these deficit areas. It is a surplus recycling mechanism. The only way that California and the state of New York can maintain a surplus vis-a-vis Illinois and Arizona is if Illinois and Arizona get investment happening in their realm in order to create the jobs and the salaries and the wages that will make it possible for the Californians and the New Yorkers to continue to have a surplus. It's not rocket science. It's just very simple logic. The kind of logic that dies when you have a debt crisis, a banking crisis, a real economy crisis of the sort that we have. Now, in Europe, we imagined that we can create a monetary union without a surplus recycling mechanism. Well, we could, as long as America was providing the requisite aggregate demand for all of us, Europeans, Japanese, the Chinese. Well, America can no longer do that. Why? Because the surplus recycling mechanism through Wall Street is kaput. So now we are stuck in a war of all against all. Currency wars between the Chinese and the Americans, the Germans against the deficit countries against Germany. What we need to realize is that if we want to save the euro, and that is essential for saving the world, it's a necessary but not a sufficient condition, because Europe is perfectly capable of dragging along with it for the third time in 100 years the rest of the globe into a postmodern disaster. If we want to save the euro, we need to reconstitute that surplus recycling mechanism. Now, we have major constraints. Time. We have days, weeks, months. We don't have years. We cannot federate. Whoever is talking about a fiscal union is his or her own worst enemy. Because over coffee, I might agree with anyone that it would be nice to have a federal Europe. But we can't have a federal Europe in the space of time which is available to us. We cannot create a common treasury that with the power to tax and borrow. We need 27 or 17, depending on what constitutional lawyers you ask, parliaments to approve it. By the time this political process unfolds, this crisis will have ensured that there is no Eurozone, and when the Eurozone goes, there will be no European Union, and there will be nothing to federate except smoldering ashes. So, if we continue along the path that we have selected over the last year and a half, which is what? Pure and perfect denial. Mr. Sarkozy and Mrs. Merkel yesterday issued yet another statement, which will be added to the statements that together will be bound up as a volume to be studied by generations of students to come as an exercise in organized idiocy. It will be the Herbert Hoover of the postmodern era. What are they saying exactly? They are saying that they want fiscal union, which means more discipline and automatic penalty mechanisms for recalcitrant countries that have a high deficit. Now, when 9/11 happened, very soon after that, the United States authorities, immigration authorities, introduced extremely expensive and magnificent machines for working out whether a passport is fake or not. And I was scratching my head. Because the people, the hijackers, used their own passports. They were perfectly legal and not fake at all. So for me, when you have a crisis and then you try to come up with a solution, part of which is meant to prevent a similar crisis from happening, the question that you should ask yourself is, if we had that mechanism before the crisis, would it have prevented the crisis? Well, those passport machines in New York and in Boston and so on would not have worked because the hijackers were using perfectly legitimate passports. Similarly, those rules, disciplinary rules, will not work. Why? Because take Spain, take Ireland. They were model states within the Eurozone. Those automatic penalties would be more readily applicable to France and Germany than to Spain and Ireland. And what happens if there is a crisis, like there was, and suddenly the housing sector in Spain falls in a hole, and the Spanish state gets into this crisis management process, and its deficit spirals out of control? Can you possibly introduce into a constitution an endogenous variable? I mean, people are looking at us outside Europe, and they're laughing their heads off. Now, you can say that thou shalt not kill. Fine. That you can put in there, in a constitution or in a piece of legislation. You can say, you can stipulate that no government can spend more than so many euros or dollars a year. That you can, I mean, it's silly to do it in a constitution, but you can do it. What you can do is determine the upper limit of a deficit in a macroeconomy where you do not control as a government the tax take. And what is the deficit? It's the difference between the tax take and expenditure. So two numbers, you subtract one from the other, you can bind yourself on a particular number for one of the two numbers, but not on the other. How can you bind yourself to the subtraction? You cannot do that. Now, are these people completely idiotic? Of course they are not. So what is behind this dithering procrastination? It is something extremely simple. The surplus countries have not determined yet whether they are prepared to bind themselves onto the mast of the Eurozone forever. Because any genuine solution to this Eurozone crisis will necessitate steps that will then make it impossible for Holland, for Austria, for Germany to exit the Eurozone. And this is something that the political elites of the surplus countries have not made their minds up yet. They are completely torn apart on this question. What they would like to do is press a pause button and leave things as they are. But history is too dynamic for pause buttons. They don't exist. And now we are in a situation where we are simply wasting the political and financial capital of Europe, of the Eurozone, pointing fingers at each other, while the real crisis is a structural one that no one is allowed to address as a structural one. Thank you.
Thank you, Yanni, very much indeed for making it very clear. A very wide-ranging talk. I didn't expect Herbert Hoover to come in there, but I could see how he came in, so thank you for that.
He's all over us.
We have time for some questions and contributions. Could I, given the size of the audience, could I just ask you to keep the questions brief at this stage so we can have as many people contributing as possible.
Shall I take them one at a time?
I was just going to ask, can we take three at a time? Okay, so can we take three? This gentleman here, please. Could you just say who you are and your questions, please?
My name is Martin Sabin. I'm not a student. I'm just an invested bystander. I'm interested in the
an obvious Christmas flavour.
I was wondering whether preferences or interests play any role in your analysis, because you mentioned that the Greek government it was imposed for the EMU criteria. I think that the Greek government was a democratically elected one, which voted, which decided to enter the Eurozone. So.
Okay, thank you. Gentleman at the back.
Michael Richards, former student of LSE. Do you expect the bond yield to stay low given that it's a type of denomination in euros? If the investors start betting into the eurozone, will they keep on lending at such low rates?
Okay. If you can synthesize those.
Okay. The first question, I very much fear that 2008 is our 1929. And I hope that Marx was right. That history repeats itself as a farce, because we don't want it to repeat itself as a carbon copy version of itself. I don't see any sign after the original extremely helpful reaction of the G20 in 2008-2009, I do not see any sign that they are capable of continuing along the same path of dealing with this crisis in the way that they did in 2008-2009. I think that it's more likely than not that they had just one bullet in their pistol and they spent it, and now they are finding it very hard to coordinate action, especially along the lines of the surplus recycling, which must take place in order to avert a deflationary spiral. Regarding preferences, of course preferences matter. Everything we do, I mean, we are economists after all. We think that our behavior is usually preference motivated. And there is no doubt that everybody in the Eurozone, not in Britain, but in the Eurozone, wanted very much to enter the Eurozone, to enter the Euro. German industrialists were very keen to do away with the uncertainty concerning the pricing of their subsidiaries. So if you have Volkswagen in Germany and you are making a gearbox in Portugal, fluctuations in the exchange rate destroy your planning as to how much your Golf four-door is going to cost. Similarly, they loathed the slide of the Italian lira because it made Fiat's, you know, catch up with Volkswagen's in Germany. So they wanted the euro. The elites in Greece, in Italy, they also wanted the euro, perhaps even more enthusiastically, because they had enough of inflationary cycles that ate into their savings. So all sorts of people wanted the euro for all sorts of different things. But that is not the question. And the question is not whether, you know, I mean, billions of people can be wrong. The fact that we had a democratically elected government, or governments, that supported the entry into the Eurozone. And anyway, look, I don't think that I'm not against the idea of a common currency. I don't want to be mistaken here, you know, to be misinterpreted. I think that a common currency is a very good idea, especially for Europe. It's just that those assumptions were wrong. And that the absence of a surplus recycling mechanism, which we can have without federation, but this is another lecture, I suppose, that was a grave error. In 1993, when Jacques Delors went to Mitterrand and said, the way we're trying to create this monetary union is going to leave it exposed to various buffeting winds and shocks. And he proposed to him a union bond, a Eurobond, a very specific one used in order to recycle surpluses, to shift, as Roosevelt was saying, savings into investment. Mitterrand listened to him for 45 minutes. It was a private meeting. And there were a few other people. One friend of mine was there present, so I have it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. And Mitterrand listened and listened and listened. After Delors stopped speaking, there was a pause of 5 minutes when the old fox was contemplating things. And then he turned around and said, you're absolutely right, and we're not going to do it. You're right because, of course, you're right, and we're not going to do it because we don't have the political clout to bind them monetarily and in other ways. But I'll tell you what will happen. Once we bind them together, then when in 10 or 15 years there is going to be an international, a global crisis, then our successors will have a choice between doing what you say or letting the euro die. And finally, the question on bond yields. You saw what happened last week. You saw that Germany found it very hard to sell. It's not because the international money markets did not want to lend to Germany. It's just that at some point, they started worrying that those bonds that they were buying, the bonds, German bonds, were denominated in euros. And they thought, the going assumption up until that moment was that if, let's say, Germany leaves the euro and it recreates the Deutschmark, the conversion of face value, of the face value of bonds, will be instantaneous. But then they started thinking, why? Perhaps it won't be instantaneous. Perhaps if this happens in 2000 and the bond matures in 2015, perhaps in 2015 they will give me, in euros or in some kind of ECU2, the value of those bonds, and that value will have diminished relative to the Deutschmark or and even relative to the dollar, because the euro will have, or what is the equivalent, the ECU2, will have diminished compared to the dollar. So the answer is no.
Can I just go back to Martin's question as to whether we're on a Titanic?
Yes.
Because you're saying that in principle you think a single currency is appropriate for the European Union. It was designed incorrectly and these assumptions made it vulnerable. But there isn't the time to do what Jean-Claude Trichet was suggesting and others, to create some kind of European Ministry of Finance or the equivalent of it, etc. And also that this week the discussion about a fiscal union that France and Germany are proposing would also be inappropriate.
So inappropriate or appropriate?
Inappropriate, I'm understanding you to say. So is your answer that it is an inevitable collapse and there is no solution to prevent that?
No. I want to remain optimistic. There is a way of salvaging this.
And what would that is?
Now, let me say this. As I said before, I'm a federalist at heart. It wouldn't be bad if we...
Some of the answers are shocking.
If we had federation now, it would be great. All I'm saying is that we cannot federate in good time.
Okay.
In order to salvage this disintegrating currency.
What would save it now?
What would save it now would be three things very quickly. We need to take three steps because we have three crises. We have a banking crisis throughout Europe, we have a debt crisis, and we have a real economic crisis. So the banking crisis requires that they unify our banking sectors. That is, it's preposterous to have national governments supervising national, but they're not national, they're international banks. So these have to be unified and they have to be forcefully recapitalized exactly the same way that Hank Paulson did it in the United States with TARP. Let's not get into this. It could happen, the EFSF could do it. The second thing we need is we need to have a degree of commonality of debt. And that could simply take place. You see, the problem now is that first Greece erupted. So the powers that be rushed to Greece to save the Union from the flames there, and by the time they had gone to Greece, Dublin had erupted, and then Portugal. So what you need is an attempt to extinguish all fires at once, even the ones that have not started yet. So in every Eurozone member country, what you could do is you could divide everybody's debt in two parts, the part that we were allowed to have according to Maastricht, and the rest, and unify the part that was that we were allowed to have by Maastricht. And do this how? The ECB is not allowed to monetize because Germans have Zachtian kind of approach to this. Okay, fine, this is another constraint we have to take under consideration. But what the ECB can do is they can issue its own bonds in the international market. In other words, the ECB could borrow instead of print on behalf of member states, effectively offer a conversion loan to the rest of the Eurozone for the Maastricht compliant part. That would make around 40-50% of the interest rate, of the total interest to be repaid by the Eurozone in the next 20 years go away. Simply go away. This is not new debt. This is reducing debt through using the good offices of the ECB to mediate with the international markets. And for that, you don't need a treaty change. Because what the treaty change bans is that the ECB opens credit accounts for us, individual member states, to get money from. But it doesn't ban the ECB from opening debit accounts in which we pay back money that the ECB borrows on in its own name from the international money market. So the third thing you need to do is you need to a new deal for Europe in terms of an investment-led recovery program, which could happen through the European Investment Bank if the European Investment Bank works together with the ECB using EIB bonds and ECB bonds, the kind of the sort that I mentioned, in order to fund an 8-9% injection, just like China is doing, into the Eurozone, not into particular countries, but into the particular regions, because there are regions of France, there are regions of Germany that are falling behind, and they will become the new Greeces if Germany breaks up.
Okay, good, thanks. Vasilis
Monsdiotis, European Institute of Hellenic Geography. I want to relate to this point you made last, but I think the story about the interruption in the recycling of surpluses is a convincing story. That's why we have the international crisis. But I don't understand how this translates to the instability of the Eurozone, because the asymmetries in the Eurozone to the extent that were there before the interruption in the recycling cycle and after, and also they are here today, but not all countries are affected, not all dead countries are affected in the Eurozone. I think that the problem I have with that, and I would ask you to respond to it, is that you somehow assume that the assumptions behind the European Monetary Union were exogenous, were something that, you know, we just decided on this assumption. Well, no, we didn't. We thought that in order to force, you know, pretty much as Mitterrand suggested, in order to force convergence, we have to put constraints on member states. How can you possibly make Greece a low inflation country and an efficient, a country that invests efficiently its resources? Well, by locking them into the Eurozone, so the extra money, the cheap money that comes to Greece from, you know, sort of free riding on the good reputation of Germany, is put in good purposes. It increases productivity, it increases the, you know, firm sizes, private capital investment, and then Greece becomes the surplus country in the same way that if you want China became the surplus country and the global recycling circle was reversed, it could also happen in the Eurozone, in theory. The reason why it didn't happen was that the politics was not strong enough, both domestically in Greece and in other sort of problem countries, and also at the Eurozone level, because we relied too much on rules, but not on this kind of political coordination that would allow things to happen. So
can I just mention that there are now then some seats here free if colleagues want to come in? Okay, thanks. Other questions, gentlemen, here.
The first graduates at the University of Greenwich.
Of?
Greenwich.
Greenwich, yes. The question is, I'm not economist, so I'm just asking, is there something we can learn from the cases of Iceland and Argentina at the moment? There's something very interesting in the way they improve their macroeconomic indicators over the years. And the second is maybe a point, I think. I didn't understand what you really mean in your second slide about the resistance and inclination of the Greeks to change. How do you define that? I mean, is the fact that we are, the country is ruled by three families in the last 50 years? Is it this idea of the open protected Greek workers, which there is a lot, of course, of evidence which describes that definitely this is not the case, that the Greek labor market was always a flexible labor market, high levels of emigration, internal immigration, the emergence of a young precarious generation, and so on.
Okay, thanks. Gentlemen here, please.
Chris Holmes, Academy of Spillway Trust. Good evening, sir.
Evening.
I've been a small critic of one aspect of your moderate proposal, in that I don't believe the European Investment Bank is a suitable vehicle for onward investment in the Euros. How do you see the EIB overcoming the difficulties I see?
Right. I'm going to answer the second part of the question because I was.
Okay.
Now, you described the hopes behind Maastricht. The hope was you bind them together, We introduce rules, 3% deficit, 60% debt to GDP ratio. And you hope that when you fuse these economies together, that there will be convergence. The point I was making is that when you do that, unless there is an explicit attempt to coordinate labor unit costs at central level, at Brussels level, and inflation rates, right, then instead of achieving convergence, then you're going to achieve divergence, regardless of the politics. The politics, of course, makes things worse. The point I was making, obviously I didn't convince you, was that even if we were all Greeks, or all Germans, or all Italians, completely unified with angels as deputies in parliament and in our seats of power, we would still have the same problem. When one country, the one with the highest degree of capital intensity in its industries, is squeezing labor unit costs down through wage deflation, the whole thing is going to start straining. And when you're didn't that strain show? It did not show because of Wall Street. Wall Street was generating oceans of liquidity. And together with the German financial industry, they were creating extremely cheap money. That cheap money created bubbles. In Spain, they took the form of real estate bubbles. In Greece, they took the form of public debt bubbles. In other words, convergence can only be achieved, even by God and his angels, if there is an attempt to minimize the inflation rate spreads and labor unit. Instead, we had the opposite attempt. Germany was struggling to reduce labor unit costs, while at the same time, the Greek government was doing the opposite. But what I'm saying is that independently of preferences and intentions, it would go down that direction if you have this divergence. And that divergence, you know what? It's only by accident that you will have convergence. The second point I want to make...
He wants to come back.
Yeah, sorry. But even if we observe the rules, yeah, and if we coordinate inflation rates and unit labor costs, by the way, unit labor costs were converging, Greek labor costs were coming from below and converging to the...
No, they were not. They were until 2001. After that, they diverged sharply.
You fixed them in 2000, then they diverged, but obviously they were lower. But anyway, okay, so even if we observe the rules and we coordinated inflation and unit labor costs, the Greek manufacturing GBA would still be 12% of GDP. So manufacturing would be 12% of the total GBA. So the economy would not be a good economy to sustain the pressures within the euro. That was the 10 years we had of cheap money was to be used in order to make the economy more competitive.
That's more realistic. What you're saying is we should have done it. That's not how capitalism works. Industrialists will only invest in capital goods if they expect a higher return in Greece than anywhere else. And there was never any reason to expect higher returns. Higher returns you could have by investing in property, by investing in bubbles. And this is what happened. And this is why I'm saying is that we should have known that only by accident will those economies converge when you bind them together. Now, the point about Iceland and Argentina. Are there lessons? There are lessons from everywhere. And I have the deepest admiration for the people of Iceland, for the way they behaved in the referenda. And I have a great admiration for Argentina and President Kirchner. But I think it's irrelevant. And I think it's irrelevant for us because in Argentina, they had a peg. They had the pesos in their pockets, which was pegged one-to-one with the US dollar. Breaking it was just a matter of an announcement. Okay? In Greece, in the Eurozone, we don't have a peg. We have the foreign currency in our pockets. There are old ladies that have withdrawn bundles of 500 euro notes and they put them under their beds or inside their freezers. Okay? The moment Greek ATMs start churning out our income flow into drachmas when our savings stock is in euros, either under the bed, freezers, or in Switzerland, right? What is going to happen is Greece is going to become like Turkey was in the 1980s, when you had a two-tier economy, most weak citizens forced to deal in a currency that was completely debased, and the rest in Istanbul, Constantinople, they were, you know, leading a good life and using French francs and Deutschmarks and US dollars. So Iceland had its own currency. It suffered a massive devaluation of 70%. That was a major shock absorber. It increased its competitiveness instantly. They suffered. I'm not saying they didn't, but it's an irrelevant lesson for Greece. I know your arguments, and I still owe you a reply,
yes,
which
yes.
I intend to,
yes.
You know, once I find myself back in Athens, I'm going to argue. Look, I agree with you. The European Investment Bank, as it has been operating so far, is not a model surplus recycling mechanism, but it has the capacity to. And let me tell you why it does. Because it, as part of the EIB group, there's also something called the European Investment Fund, which has the capacity to operate as a kind of fund for small SMEs, as venture capital, and its remit, since 1998, includes technology and technology transfers, health, education, and urban renewal, which means effectively everything. And this is particular for SMEs. How we're going to shake this up is a matter, is a project, an ongoing project, one that hasn't begun yet. Having said that, if the Eurozone adopts the idea that something like an investment bank, which we already have and we can develop, will be necessary to start recycling surpluses and shifting savings into investment, then we can talk about how we can move away from the old-fashioned infrastructure-based New Deal ideal to something which is much more in tune with the times.
My argument is that the problem is the interface that all us entrepreneurs, I'm an inventor, by the way.
You mean the Greek state?
Mm-hmm.
The Greek state.
Well, any, it doesn't matter
yeah.
who you are, but when you're looking at the economy, I'm looking at it right down at the grassroots,
sure.
The individual. Put a bright idea, one to employees, next door neighbor, get on with it. The problem you have is the interface. You have a vast wall of faceless bureaucrats that really don't want to invest in anything as tiny as you down there. And I'm trying to get my own project on the go by selling some IP, but that's not worked. So I'm now in discussions with the Bank of England to see whether they can fire QE at my IP. So not, don't hold your breath.
I'm not holding it. I just tried to get to emit a little bit of hope that there are things we can do.
Okay, other contributions, the gentleman at the back.
Thank you. I'm Sukhanal Pantero, so I'm a master's graduate from Warwick. And I would like to ask if you believe that the current monetary system, which is the dollar standard, if you think that it's kind of deflationary, and perhaps makes the ECB incapable of working as a supply mechanism, as a recycling mechanism, as you described before. And if you say that a monetary system like perhaps Keynes, an international clearing union,
mm-hmm.
With a global reserve currency, instead of having the dollar to play this role, would be not now an emergency solution.
Okay, thank you. Other gentlemen here.
Hi, my name is Babis Tinis. I'm seeking comprehension. And through your talks and writings all this time, it's providing quite a lot for us. So thank you, Jens, for your talk. Basically, the question is, based on the reaction so far of the European elite and the fact that historically we've gone out of large crises like the one that we're finding ourselves in right now through big conflicts, how likely do you think is that we will try and keep this Minotaur alive by sending him off to fight some wars in, I don't know, Iran, Syria, North Korea, and so how probable do you think that is, and if you think it's going to work, and what kind of world is going to be after that?
Other questions, contributions
as well? I'm interested in a Greek perspective on what's going on right now with the conviction of a messenger right now in the statistician that actually said that the Greek level is of debt is higher than this really that was said before.
Okay. Is the dollar standard deflationary? Not per se. The dollar standard is neutral as a system. What makes it deflationary is the fact that Ben Bernanke is the only person capable presently of preventing the American economy from falling off the edge. And the reason why is because even though he is effectively reflating the American economy through quantitative easing, in an environment where everybody else is doing the opposite, we have, you know, globalized austerity outside the United States of America. This is creating a dynamic whereby capital is shifting from the United States of America, simply because it's cheaply produced there or reproduced, entering the BRICS, okay, creating bubbles there that the BRICS are trying to stop by means of higher interest rates, which have a deflationary effect, while the American economy is not responding to Bernanke's treatment. So the overall effect is deflationary, even though I don't blame the dollar standard for that. I think that the old-fashioned idea that we should have only one reserve currency is bad. It's perfectly capable of having between two and three reserve currencies, and actually it would be a good idea. The second question, I sincerely hope not. The good news is that there's no large enough enemy with which to have a large enough war. That's a good news. Yeah, I mean, Libya, you know, for a few months, it was over.
It's still France.
Yeah. Or invade Poland again. Your question. The question refers to, I don't know whether the rest of you know about this, I think quite a delicious little story in Greece now, that the head of the Greek Statistical Office is being investigated for having overreported the deficit of the Greek budget deficit for 2009. Now, let me tell you what I think is happening. By the way, hasn't been convicted, and there will not be a court case. It was a statutory investigation simply because this was some allegation made by some politician or by a newspaper, but it was an allegation by members of the board who were fired. So the DA, the Sagellaeus, has a statutory obligation to investigate it. I have no doubt that they will dismiss the case. What I think has happened is this. He did inflate the figure by 1%. I can't tell you why he did it. There are two alternative competing theories here. One is the conspiracy theory, which is not necessarily always wrong, you know. After all, there was such a thing as Watergate. Not all conspiracy theories are bunk. The conspiracy theory is that it was essential that there was yet another deviation, upward deviation of the deficit at the time when it was reported, in order to convince certain recalcitrant members of the PASOK party to vote for further austerity measures. So if he was in cahoots with the government to do that, then there is a case to answer. I'm not saying he was, but this is one possibility. The other possibility, which is in my mind more likely, is that he was erring on the side of overstating in order to undo a long reputation of understating the Greek budget deficit.
I think we've got five more minutes. If it's possible. Okay, gentlemen here, please.
Do you think that that America has a political interest in the breakup
of Europe? No, they don't. Exactly, precisely the opposite. Sorry for having.
It's okay.
No. They are panicking at the prospect. I mean, I was at the Fed 2 weeks ago. They are panicking. They really wish, they go to bed at night praying that Europe will find a way out of this. Because if the Eurozone breaks up, what will happen is there will be two zones, or three. The surplus country zones that will be immediately hit by recessionary waves. The rest, we're going to find ourselves in the mire of stagflation. This will mean a reduction in demand for American exports, for Chinese exports. Currency wars will flare up, and America is going to topple, to fall into the second dip of the recession.
Gentlemen,
here. I'm Martin Williams. Not studying anywhere. It seems to me very obvious that your proposals for solving the euro crisis would work. Perhaps because no one else has given me any proposals that I think would work. But what I don't understand is, I mean, you said that the elites in the surplus countries haven't decided what to do. I mean, presumably they're as capable of understanding this as anybody else is, and know what potentially could work. What are the interests that are speaking in their ears saying, don't do this? What, I mean, is the recapitalization of the banks, does that mean the banking class is against it? Why wouldn't it happen?
Well, firstly, let's not forget that already there are a number of influential people in Germany calling for the reconstitution of the Deutsche Bank. So here, there you are. I mean, that's one group that they are putting their hand up in the air and saying, we not only do we not want to commit ourselves to the euro forever, but we want to get out to yesterday.
That's
now,
not good for
what
them,
interests lie behind them? I think you put your finger on the nail. If the Deutsche Mark is reconstituted tomorrow, then the inflow of capital into German banks is going to be gigantic. So suddenly all those insolvent German banks, and I include Deutsche Bank in it, and anybody who is for Deutsche Bank here, please sue me. Deutsche Bank is insolvent. I keep saying this, and I'm asking for Deutsche Bank to sue me, but they're not doing it, and I'm getting increasingly frustrated. They will not be insolvent anymore. So then they will not need to lose control of their banks. So there are definitely businesses. But look, the exporting industries were adamantly opposed to the breakup of the euro. But I have to tell you that 2 weeks ago, I started feeling shivers down my spine when I heard the head of the German Exporters Association Chamber effectively conceding that perhaps, you know, it's all over. So advocating plan B, which is for the Bundesbank to start planning for the Deutschmark and to start planning for carrying out policies similar to that of the Central Bank of Switzerland in order to peg the new Deutschmark to the dollar and not to allow it to appreciate beyond a certain limit through infinite purchases of dollars or yen or whatever. So, look, Mrs. Merkel at the moment, and I feel for her, she has 10 different advisors, each telling a different story, and she's been pulled in different directions at once. Some say strengthen the fiscal union, some say let's go for the Deutsche Mark, others saying leave it as it is, let it collapse, and let's see what happens then. It's a mess.
My question is around the possibility of introducing a new recycling mechanism that you mentioned earlier that started in the States. And I'm thinking that at that time states were powerful enough as a body, as a country, to be able to regulate, to be able to make rules, set the rules of how things are going to run. Do you think currently there's a body or a country that has the power to lead the way, because the current problem seems like there's not enough agreement from everyone involved? So do you think, and also part of your proposal, there's someone strong enough to lead the pack?
The quick answer is no. But I hope that, I mean, in conversations over the last 2 years with various people on different continents, I was very pleasantly surprised by the degree of literacy, macroeconomic literacy, of the Chinese authorities, the Indian authorities, the Brazilian authorities. Perhaps the leadership will come from there. They're already coordinating quite substantially. The Americans understand what's going on. The only problem with America is that it is an ungovernable country. You know, the administration is locked into mortal combat with Congress. And the only people that can actually do things are the ones in the Fed. The worst offenders are the Europeans. And that's why I keep saying that you're well that which Greece is to Europe.
I think we might have time for one last question. Yes, please.
So what's your view on the future of sterling vis-a-vis euro?
Well, anybody who predicts exchange rate fluctuations is either very foolish or extremely wise, and I'm not that wise. But what I'm telling you is that what I will say is that just like the Continentals were too rash, too quick to congratulate themselves after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, that you know that they were wiser than the Anglo-Saxons. I think the Brits are too rash to congratulate themselves for having stayed out of the euro. Because life outside the euro can be pretty good, pretty commodious, when the euro is doing well. And it can be quite tolerable when the euro is entering the first phase of its crisis, because the flexibility of the exchange rate gives the British economy, and gave the British economy, the opportunity to absorb the shock. But when we are pulled down globally by disintegrating Eurozone, Britain, having deindustrialized recklessly in the 1980s and early 1990s, is going to find itself very soon in the same vicious cycle that Greece finds itself. And I know this sounds really awful and ominous, but I believe it very strongly.
Okay. Well, I think we have to bring things to a conclusion, that's okay. Thank you all for coming. It's testimony to the reputation and the presentation that Yanis has made that attracts so many people. So thank you very much for making the presentation. Yanis has just announced that he's quite happy to go to the pub, the George, opposite here. Being an economist, he's not offering to buy you a drink.
thank you.